Hey, dude, badders, it's David. I've just finished interviewing with Frankie, and this episode is great, actually. The areas we go into that I hadn't necessarily expected that I think you'll love is one of them to do with training high school students in cross country and the level of mileage that he feels is that actually teenagers can handle, but also the evolution of the sport was fascinating and how the differences between the number of trainers people are now wearing and the trainer they're wearing while they train is having an impact on how much mileage they can take and changing the rules of not only the distances that younger athletes are running, but also the ability to then carry that through to later years. We also talked about his run crew of over a thousand people running that's got something like 30,000 followers on Instagram. It's absolutely massive. And he talks through this his kind of secrets of why that's been a success and the key to ensuring that you can still have these big runs without it either losing its spirit or becoming destructive on the local area. And then we finish off all to do with bandits, which I explained in this intro. So take it away, Nick.
They're bad, they're boys, and occasionally they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back. Baby, come back.
With a bye, 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 bye. With a bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
So, you guys, on our next guest, if you're from North America, you would know him for sure because of the impact he's had in so many different areas, whether that's massive running clubs, starting the Miami Marathon, training an incredibly good cross-country team. But I wanted to get him on to really talk about bandits because I know bandits are something that used to be quite a part of trail and ultra culture. And you could turn up to a race and you wouldn't help yourself to stuff, but it was almost accepted that there'd be individuals there potentially just running along, running the course, using it as a training run. But Frankie has a big city marathon, very different, where you have to consider a huge amount more. So I wanted to get the background on what the impact is of things like bandit runners, but then also tell the wider story of the Miami Marathon, his incredible run clubs, his incredible cross-country clubs. So welcome to the podcast, the wonderful Frankie Ruiz. Yay!
Thank you. Thank you. It sounds like there's 100 people in here. I appreciate the invite.
Which came first of your, you've got, you train a youth team in cross country, you've got the running club, you've got the Miami Marathon. Like, did they all flow through each other, or was one a kernel that started the rest?
So there, now that I look back, they're all attached, right? Like when you're first starting out, you don't really see that all the dots are all going to connect. And I was fortunate enough that I was one of the few, I would say, that early on in his career, or I should say my professional career, identified that running was going to be the center of pretty much everything. And I was lucky enough that I had an opportunity to be coaching a school team, or in this case, a high school team, early on in my, you know, let's call it first few years of the real world after college. And while doing so, I ran into, it's probably a better word related to running, ran into this idea that the Miami market needed a marathon. And and here we are 23, 24 years later with a major marathon, half marathon in a city that a lot of people said was too humid, too hot to support one.
Yeah.
And then along the way, all these running clubs, and I just got deeper and deeper into coaching. So I just kept the ecosystem all pretty connected.
And with when you first were doing the coaching, were you doing that as a almost a side job as part of being a teacher, or do kind of high schools in America have the budgets to actually employ people specifically for their sports?
Yeah, I had no interest in being a teacher, so I was just doing it on the side, if you will, as I finished my master's degree, or in the States it's called, your grad school. And no, there isn't a big budget on the high school front, but running is a sport that most schools have. I coach at a Jesuit high school, and athletics in general are a big deal to the Jesuits, and track and field and cross country are two obviously running related sports. But I wasn't teaching at the school, so I sort of realized real early on, I got to give a lot of thanks to, just being inspired by people around me or something to come up with this. But I realized that I was going to have to build my life and my professional life around this drive to be a coach. So I thought, what job is going to allow me to, leave at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to go see a bunch of high school kids? And then I can support a family with that money, and or not that money of coaching, but the money that I'm making doing something else. And it just worked out where I was doing running during the day, production and organization and promotion of running events. And then in the afternoons, I was, off and running with a bunch of high school kids. So,
And how is, because my exposure to cross country was until the age of 13. We hated it. It was cold. It was wet. It was muddy. And then there was a cross country team that everyone tried to avoid it at kind of high school level. But it was always seen as you could only be in that team unless you were unbelievably gifted, if you weren't needed by the rugby team or by the hockey team. Or in the States, how is cross country kind of perceived by high schoolers, and how is it perceived within the ecosystem of high school as well?
So I think it's seen its ups and downs. I think it's on the up now. I can't say it was on the up 20 years ago when I first got into it, or even when I ran as a high schooler. We'll give a big brand's name here as a recognition. Nike's credit a few years back in this idea that it was the final sport, or one of the few sports, let's call it, that didn't have a national championship in the States. And they created one. It's called NXN. And that seemed to catapult the sport's status. And I can't say it's seen as cool as being on the football team, in our case, American football, or even as cool as being on the basketball team, but it's getting there. It really has. It's seen more and more as a team sport. For many years, it was called a no cut sport. It's still kind of that for a lot of schools. What that means is that as a coach, you took anybody who wanted to run on your team. There's certain schools that just don't have the room anymore because they have too many athletes already that are running. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that running is a little more mainstream. It's not seen as the outcast sport anymore. And I think it's cool that it isn't, but there was something cool about it being the outcast sport in the States for that matter. Look, it's not as messy as yours. Cross country in the States is done in the fall. So our fall, for the most part, across the country is pretty mild, unless you're in the Northwest, but or even maybe parts of the Northeast. But most of us, I live in Miami, so it's hot, it's humid, it's maybe wet, maybe a little muddy, but it's certainly not cold. cold. If I told you what cold is for us, you'd be laughing. Put it this way, I don't think our refrigerators get as cold as you guys have to run, your cross country meets. Because I think most of your meets are in the spring, if I'm not mistaken. If that's correct, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of runs from late autumn through to just pre-marathon, really, typically.
Got it. Yeah. So here, to the listeners, so they understand, you can, a lot of, there's even club cross country teams at a 10 year old, 11, 12 year old level. And then you move through middle school and you start in high school and high school things get a little more serious. A lot of kids are running for college attention. If you want to get into a school to run, say cross country, you better be also a good track athlete or a good distance runner on the track. If you want to be in on track and you're a middle to long distance runner, you better be good on cross country, out in cross country. Anyhow, the high schools do a pretty darn good job of coaching kids to a level that eventually allows them to transition into the collegiate level. And the NCAA system is pretty robust when it comes to collegiate running, cross country running competition. And then after that, we don't have professional cross country. You know, I wish we did. I mean, there's a handful of teams that race for USA Track and Field, but it's not, there isn't a league. There isn't, if a race is held, there's no spectators. So it's sort of, it's almost inverted to what you guys have. Yeah. Right?
I quite often see on Runner's World, there'll be articles about someone like Kate Tui or about the speed of some of the runners, or they'll be talking. I think last year there was one team that had something like five or six runners under 15:30 or something like that for 5Ks. And is that because of when you get these clusters of incredible teams, is that down, do you think, to the coach and the methodology and the expectation, or is there an element of schools still recruiting from regions and in the same way you would for football or for baseball or other sports, people would actually move and go specific to high schools because of their cross country programs?
Yes. So, how can I address that? It during COVID, people started to move. They started to move to places that had sport. That was the only time that I think people were moving to schools because of the running. Most of the programs that exist, I have to say, they build it from the ground up. Like, they're not recruiting athletes. In fact, a lot of the schools are not allowed to recruit. A lot of the states have policies against and the rules against recruiting. So you basically have to take a kid, sometimes a scrawny kid that doesn't have any coordination or any athletic ability, and turn them into an athletic runner. And that I do have to attribute that to a lot of the coaches in our sport have really learned how to coach. It used to be a very participatory event, or I should say a sport, where it's just like, just get them running and they'll get better as they age. Now I think it's gotten a little more scientific. There's a lot more sharing of knowledge. You mentioned one team that a couple years back that got a lot of even national, international news, which was the Newberry Park team, and that elevated the standard, if you will, of what was fast. And then you couple that with shoes, and you have some teams. I mean, my team last year, their average was in the low 15s. And I had two kids under 15 for the 5K. And that's another thing. I don't know if I mentioned that, but yes, our cross country races are all standard 5 kilometers. There's a couple of states that run 3 miles, but everybody pretty much runs 3.1 miles, which is obviously.
Love that. 5K. They've got to be different. They've got to just for that 0.1.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And so then with them, because how much training would say you're talking about, you've mentioned some people you kind of dragged through trying to turn into athletes, but you've also got, I mean, these sub 15K runners, that's a good runner as an adult, really good runner. What's their weekly mileage? What kind of sessions are they going through? And how there's an element of needing to protect kind of young adults as well, especially when they're developing. How is there a limit, or are there guidelines, or how do you ensure that the mileage isn't potentially damaging them in the long term?
Yeah. So I've been doing this for a bit, and I'll confess and say that my early athletes were experiments, and I can apologize to them now as they're older and say I broke a couple of you.
They're all in wheelchairs, just being pushed around.
Well, no, not that far. No, I mean, you know, some of them did suffer through injury that was arguably caused through maybe some overtraining. But I would say that as long as, at least these are my rules, as long as I'm giving them adequate recovery between tough workout days. I'm giving them a varied running surfaces. And Miami's tough because we don't have a lot of trails and we don't have a lot of soft stuff, but as long as I'm varying the surface a bit and I'm also being cognizant of their fitness age. In other words, if I have a kid who just started in ninth grade, in our case, that would be like a 14-year-old, give or take. If I have a 14-year-old that's never done anything, he didn't even play soccer or football, he didn't play anything, and he just decides he wants to be a runner, I can't start that kid, you know, and move him to a 60-mile week in a few weeks. So we're definitely a lot smarter when it comes to that. But I got a kid that ran with his club team and was a basketball player and he's athletic and he's developed, and I get that kid, I can push that kid a little further in his weekly mileage total. I do operate on a 10-day cycle, but if I had to break down my 7-day, 7 days probably on average about 50 to 60 miles a week. And a lot of that is on doubles, you know, on 2-a-days.
Yeah. Okay.
It just, that also has helped also, because sending a kid on a 10-mile run isn't as effective in my eyes as giving them a 6 and a 4 mile, you know, session, just because kids don't sleep enough. They don't eat enough. They don't rest enough. And it eventually does work its way into some kind of stress or overuse injury.
Yeah. I mean, that's a heavy mileage, because if you follow a standard like sub-3 marathon training plan, you're looking at probably maxing out at that mileage. So,
yeah, but you know what's interesting though, because I don't want to scare people that are listening. And I, like I said, I'm not breaking kids this time around. I mean, I do have an occasional stress fracture here and there. That's just, it's impossible to completely prevent. But I think it's distribution, right? Like a marathoner has this sort of like, it's almost like this, we're a little bit old school here describing this, but you know, I run 6 miles this Saturday, and next Saturday I run 7 miles. And then the Saturday after that, I run 8 miles. And then they bring themselves up to the, whether they're running their 20 miler 2 weeks before the race or 3 weeks before the race. Cross country, we don't treat it that way. One, I coach time-based for the first 10 weeks or so. So we're not clocking miles necessarily. Although you can still record it and get an idea. And then intensity, right? I think intensity is something that adults, for whatever reason, don't do a great job of regulating, right? And high school kids, they'd listen, at least the ones I've got listen, you know, for the most part. So there's a difference there. But yeah, I can see where the mileage scares somebody. And don't forget that these kids are running, at least my kids are running 6.5 days a week. And I say a half because I'll run 7 days a week every other week. During the summer, for that matter.
Okay, and something we've discussed quite a few times on the podcast before is, not just in kind of high school, but actually in lots of coaching throughout, is how challenging it can be to for male coaches to coach females and understand kind of menstrual cycles and how that interacts with their training, but also being able to pick up on things like reds and to have the connection to be able to ensure that young athletes of both sexes are fueling sufficiently. Like, is that something that do you feel that is addressed in the States in the same way that they're trying to address it in the UK now? And is that awareness throughout the coaches and the staff that you know, would you say?
Yeah, I think there has been an improvement in that department. And I'm lucky enough, I'm married to a sports dietitian, and she's able to give me a lot of the answers that I'd probably have to go searching for somewhere. So I've been fortunate enough to have that, but you are seeing a lot of teams bring nutrition into the program as a regular sort of, either whether it's seminars, teaching the parents, introducing the kids to gels and things that you wouldn't have done 10 years ago. So definitely nutrition has increased its presence in our sport. And I would say it's made a difference in what I've done in the last 10 years or what our program has done. I only coach boys, but my wife gives talks to a ton of girls teams, and the issue you have with the girls teams, she's always telling me this, and I thank God I have a daughter, and maybe one day I'll end up coaching her, but I don't have to deal with under eating as a result of body image. And that's a big problem she deals with in a lot of her talks. In my case, that high school boys aren't under eating because of the way they look. They're under eating because they don't have the patience to sit down and eat. You know, it's a little different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, well, it's a lot of extra, 6,000 extra calories a week, isn't it? So, and do you think, I'd say particularly in the UK, people's route into adult cross country tends to be either I'm not very good at sport and I start to get fat as an adult, so I start running, or I'm quite good at sport, but due to injury or lack of either convenience or aging, I can no longer do that sport, so I start running. But we don't seem to have a huge connection between kind of the youth and the old. Do you get a sense that people who are training at that volume in their teens, do they carry it through typically, or does it almost create a volume and an association with the youth that when they get older, they almost cut ties with it?
I think I'm using this phrase a lot. We're turning the corner. Athletes I've coached are showing up to my run club, and that makes me real happy, because I'm not bumping into them at a bar or in a place where I'm seeing that they're treating their bodies different than they treated them when they were in high school. I can't say the same of about maybe 15 years ago. I see some of those kids now, which aren't kids anymore. They're adults. And I'm like, and you've gained a ton of weight. You're not running. You're not exercising. What was it? And, you know, I got burned out, and you get some of that. But I think part of the difference as to why we're seeing it now is at least where I live and in the States in general, running really has become part of a city's social lubricant, social network, social
identity, almost.
Identity. Yeah, it's become part of the city's DNA to a certain extent, and I think that affects an athlete, right? An athlete that was an athlete in high school says, now there's a system to support this, and it's not all just like, I'm gonna knock now some old school running programs, but it's not like just a bunch of walkers trying to raise money for, you know, crossing a finish line that's a marathon. It's actually something that there's 20 something year olds getting together and running for fun, you know, on an evening like I have here in Miami. So that's helped out a bit.
And when I kind of coming into the sport, everyone's always said you had a 10 year peak. So no matter how old you were, you start running at 70, you're going to peak at 80, maybe not there, but, you know, Gene Dyke would disagree. Do you think
that's right?
Do you think that that's still the case, that and is there an element of limiting that if your 10 year is from when you're training hard and you're starting at 16, are we almost exposing these kids to peaks in the mid 20s, which sadly is true in a lot of other areas, or do you think actually the rules are changing and there's not necessarily a very good rule to assume it happens to most people anymore?
I feel like the rules are being broken on a daily basis, right? I see some guys in their 40s, and I just think, all right, those are the 20s of 20 years ago. Whether it's shoes, whether it's training plans, whether it's the sharing of information through online coaching, if it's I think we've gotten a lot more intelligent when it comes to extending the peak or extending the life of a runner. I can't say. I think the rules are changing for sure.
And last one to do. I didn't think we'd be speaking so much about high school cross country, but
I can talk about it forever.
Yeah. One thing that has massively changed when I was at school, even doing like a school trip abroad to try and learn French or something was a huge financial strain on some families, let alone it needing to be a pair of trainers to be faster for two or three races. how prevalent are the super shoes amongst high school runners? Is it seen as a bare requirement now? And does that is that an issue for parents and for, I guess, access to excellence for runners that haven't got the financial means?
Sure. So I thought you were going somewhere else with the question. I thought you were going to say about trips and training trips, because that's become really common here. But we can talk about that another time. That teams are taking month-long trips now in the summer. But yeah, it's pretty neat to places like Flagstaff and whatnot.
Yeah.
But no, on the shoe topic, I'm fearful of the one sport that always touted itself as being very democratic, open to anybody, and low barrier to entry, has become to a certain extent, it's almost like golf here in the States, right? Mm. Expensive clubs, you know, help you hit the ball harder. Getting there with running, the kids that I first started coaching had one pair of shoes for practice and one pair of shoes for racing. And that was a luxury, right? Like they had, you know, a $80 pair of running training shoes. And then they had a $60 pair of waffles or whatever they were called back then, the racing spikes. And now my kids actually asked me, and I coach at a Jesuit school, decent means. But I hear this from all kinds of coaches. I'm not just saying it in mine, where the coach is asked, hey, what's our workout tomorrow? Oh, okay. I'll bring these shoes for that workout. Mm. And so I think super shoes now even brought more broad, you know, before we were saying super shoes just for racing, but now there's super shoes are part of practice. And that is, whether you have a tempo shoe, you have a shoe that you use for your long runs, you have a shoe that you use for recovery runs. I mean, it's like they're almost showing up to practice with, like, you know, kind of like a soldier has different guns. You know, it's the same concept. So I do fear that there will be a divide here where the has and the has nots, or the have and the have nots, are not going to be an equal playing field when it comes to a race.
And actually, that becomes challenging for setting even the training to, if we do find that using the super shoes, one, could be potentially damaging to Achilles, but actually is meaning that you're not getting quite as much wear and tear on your legs. It's very hard then to set one training plan for an individual who's got one pair of trainers for the whole week and an individual who's constantly looking after their legs because of their switching around shoes and having these super shoes.
Yep. Yeah. I have a meeting with the parents every year. And one of the things I tell the parents, I'm like, think of the shoes that are on the market now as shoes that help you train better, because your legs can take a lot more through them. At least I've come to that conclusion. I don't know if it's necessarily all the science points to it, rather than just buying them shoes so that they can run fast at a race. And I think that's where the real secret lies, or I shouldn't say a secret, but the real magic happens is not necessarily that the kid can race fast. It's the fact that the kid can handle more, from practice to practice, and the legs aren't a shot. Like I regularly pull my kids on a daily basis. Sometimes I ask them, how sore are we? And 5 years ago, these same workouts would have made you so sore. And now I have kids the next day saying, I've got no soreness. And that just lights me up. I'm just like, that's great. I can keep pushing you, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So you've mentioned then about how a lot of your athletes then join the run club. I hadn't realized the Brickell Run Club had like 30,000 followers on Instagram, which is massive for a run club. Right?
Yeah.
What's the magic sauce?
Yeah. We started in 2009, where running clubs were, I've also used this term a couple of times today, old school, where it was a president and a vice president and a membership fee, and it was run out of the back door of a running store or something. And we realized that in Miami, we didn't even really have that. That wasn't even now that big at the time in 2009. And together with Nike, we launched a small run club out of South Beach. Everyone listening might know where South Beach is. It's Miami Beach. It's what actually everybody thinks Miami's like.
I know, and from Grand Theft Auto, started, the game.
Exactly, Grand Theft Auto. Yeah, so anyhow, we started with a group there, and the idea was it was going to be organic. It was going to be consistent every Thursday night. And Miami responded, Miami Beach, and the local, runners and the residents responded, and we made it everything but the running was featured. It was the social side, it was the fun side, it was what you wear. It really wasn't about the running, and we never skipped a Thursday. We were there every Thursday night. We didn't bring any politics into it, so there was no president, no director. I would just lead them, and that was it. It was 3.5 miles every day, every Thursday, rather 6 kilometers basically. And it went really well. We grew, a couple hundred were showing up every Thursday night. And then we realized there was this other part of town called Brickell, which is, those that don't know Miami very well, this is slightly outside the downtown area. And Brickell was on the up and coming. There was new buildings coming in. So we launched there, small group, same 5 or 6 people meeting out of a parking lot. And we are now almost 14 years, give or take about 14 years later. And the group is on an everyday, every week basis, every Tuesday night, with crowds as big as 1,000 to our smallest crowd of 600. And it's free. It's open to the public. It's open to anybody that wants to join, all ages. We have wheelchairs out there. We have kids. We've got strollers. We got it all. And this has just blown up. And I can't say enough about it. Like, it's my favorite night of the week. 50 weeks a year, we don't miss a week. We're there if it's storming. We don't get snow, so we don't have to worry about that. We're there if it's dry, if it's wet, if it's hot. It doesn't matter. We're there no matter what.
And why do you think? Because we've talked to organizations like Midnight Runners, City Runners,
sure,
where it almost seems that there becomes a size that becomes unmanageable, or that the community changes and no longer represents what it represented. So why do you think that yours has almost broken through those barriers, and what is it that you think really appeals to people about this club? Because it's, to me, 1,000 people, you might not even find your friend. You might turn up and not see them in the whole 5K because there's mm-hmm. so many people in the way. So why do you mm-hmm. think this has succeeded so well?
I can't say that there's one thing. There's certainly, some guesses I can make. I think Miami is a growing city that has many challenges when it comes to your recent arrival to the city. If you, a lot of people move to the city and they spend some time here and then they move on, and it's become it was a very transient place. It was also a tourist town, and so people lack this ability to connect with the city. It just aren't a lot of opportunities to do so, and we gave them that. And we didn't make it a matchmaking club. I don't encourage birthday celebrations. I try to make sure it doesn't seem too clicky or too niche-y. I don't necessarily celebrate the fast runners. I don't celebrate the slow runners. I just kind of celebrate everybody. So that's some of the theory, is that Miami doesn't have a lot of offerings like this. And so we've been able to sort of break through that. And I think the last part is sort of, I shouldn't say last part, but one of the other parts that we have to take into account, Miami's weather is pretty daunting if you want to be a fast runner. It's a hard place to be a good long distance runner. Yeah. And so we embrace that. And one of the ways we've embraced that is that we haven't made it about the exact distance. We haven't made it about times. And that's helped. That's helped out a lot. And but we've also not tried hard not to cross over into like the fitness world, right? Where it's just like, just come out and sweat and work out. No, we're still trying to stay true to the sport. I don't know, it's worked until now. Yes, we use music and yeah, we have, you know, just things that you might see in some of these other groups you mentioned. But we've really kept it true to the sport, true to the city, and consistent no matter what, we're there.
So then I'm going to do a few quick fire questions on this one, just because I know people will be fascinated who are from run clubs themselves. So first question, always same routes or different?
No, different routes. We have about 10, 15 routes that we use.
What happens then with things like road closures, police, crossing safely, all those things? Is it now large enough? It consumes wherever it goes, or is it something you have to consider?
I consider it when I make the routes. I consider it. We try not to impact the same areas more than a couple of times in a row. We also take part in a lot of good-hearted things, clogging and cleanups, and things to show the inconveniences are weighed out a bit by the other good that we do. I'm sure I've got some bad actors, some folks, you know, that come in and don't do us any favors by not waiting for a light and blocking the road or whatnot. But yeah, I mean, listen, we are at a point where it is really big and disruptive, but I've been as responsive as possible. Or I shouldn't say responsible as possible to share, you know, the constant guidance to the runners that, hey, we're, you know, this is a privilege. We don't take over anything. We don't take over roads, even though for a short period of time it may seem that way, but that's not what we're here. We're not here to, you know, disrupt things in that fashion.
Do you start from a different location each week then, or do you have a base, and what happens to bags and stuff?
Same location for the start. Sometimes we do what we call an invasion, and we'll finish somewhere that welcomes us with a free drink or a sample or something that...
So 1,000 free drinks.
Oh, yeah. You'd be surprised how many... There's last 2 weeks ago, there was a business that gave sandwiches to all 1,000 people. And wow. And so we've become part of the business fabric also, because these businesses need to advertise and we need to eat, you know, so why not? And it all works, you know, so
And so have you then created, are there kind of captains or sub leaders or like positions like that to just try and help shepherd people, communicate with people?
Yes. We have a team of about 8 to 10 pacers. I'm fortunate enough that we're powered by Nike. So we get some help from them. We've always had them as partners since the inception. They've kept us as one of their most consistent groups around the world. We have them. We call them pacers. And I actually even pay them. I've got a modest, you know, a stipend for them because they deserve to be paid. I train them even, and we do what you say, which is wrangle and sort of shepherd the crowd as best as we can.
And what happens post run typically?
Post run, I may lead a core session. One of the pacers may lead a core session, about 6 or 7 minutes worth. We turn up the music, people hang out. We may have a brand or two that comes out and gives some free product. And it, all in all, it lasts from the minute you get there to the minute you leave, probably an hour and 15 minutes total, an hour and a half maybe. It's about the format.
Interesting, because I'd say a huge number of our run clubs or run crews, it all heads to the pub straight afterwards. And that seems to be the way.
We haven't. I mean, like if we invade a place that happens to be a pub or a restaurant, but you'd be surprised. Like, it hasn't become a thing. Like it's pretty wholesome to say. Mm. You know? Not that drinking is bad or anything, but it isn't about that. And I've been careful not to make it only about, you know, socializing either. Because I want, this may sound, you know, a little controversial, but I want the wife to feel comfortable that their husband or their boyfriend is going to the run club, and it's not about going out after and getting wasted or drunk and ruining a Tuesday night, you know. Mm.
And we've seen, because run clubs in the UK have been around a similar amount of time, actually, kind of 10 years or so, maybe some a few more. But we've seen the last kind of 3, 4 years, there's almost been growing pains where the leadership of the crews have maybe lost connection with the heart, or aren't quite as involved, or and it's caused frictions in some clubs. Like, do you think you'll always be leading this club? And if not, do you think it needs like a central figure who's selfless to survive? Or do you think actually it's in quite a, if you were to step aside, it's in quite a healthy position, and it doesn't necessarily need that kind of charismatic leader to drive it forward.
I go back and forth on this. Look, right after COVID, New York showed up in Miami. All of New York, just those that don't know the differences in terms of politics, New York was closed up until, the last moment. They were closed. They just didn't allow people to gather and whatnot. And Florida, where Miami's located, just kind of ignored
I guess it's
anything that
Ron
was happening.
DeSantis versus whoever
Yes,
the
correct, correct. Like them or not, that's what we did, right? And we're all here and we're still telling the story. But nonetheless, a lot of New Yorkers showed up in Miami, and New York was, as always, is always sort of a little bit ahead of the curve, and they had running crews. And so a lot of folks showed up here and they wanted to start their own running crews, and many have. And at first, people were asking me, "Oh, look, so they're starting this and that out here." And I thought to myself, initially, I was like, "Yeah, like it's all competition." But for whatever reason, it's working in Miami. And I think the brands are to blame for some of that territorial feelings towards one another. So it hasn't quite, gotten to that level. And people call me, they'll call me, "Oh, you're the founder of the running scene in Miami." And I said, "No, don't give me that much credit." But I do think that it takes a personality or a few personalities to come together and say, "Listen, we can either ruin this for everybody or we can all get along and make this bigger for everybody." And I think most of the running groups are very amicable with one another. I try hard not to give us to make us the most United Nations type of running club. And I try not to just say that. We really tell the Pacers, we tell everybody, we're like, "Listen, if look, Johnny wants to run and all the different run clubs, you will never say, well, you're part of this crew and not part of that crew, and you shouldn't go to this neighborhood and that neighborhood." Not sure what you know about Miami or not, but Miami has neighborhoods, but it's okay to go run in downtown if you're from down south, or if you're from Miami Beach, it's okay to run in Little Havana. And that's pretty unique to our city. And I want it to stay that way. I want all cultures and races and socioeconomic levels to all run together, which is what running is, right? When you go run the London Marathon, or you go run the New York Marathon or the Boston Marathon, you're on the start line with all kinds of people. And I want that run club to be that. So if every so often somebody feels that the group isn't fitting them yet, I'll blame myself because I'll say, "Gosh, I guess I don't have enough different people for them." But I won't take it personal if they go in and start another group on their own. It's just even better. I think now Miami, last count I had probably about 29 different running groups. And Miami's not that big. It's about 2.5, 2.7 million people. So it's not New York where you have 10 million living within 10 miles. So we have room. We have room for more personalities and more charismatic leaders, as you say.
So onto the bandits then. That's gonna be there.
That's what everybody wants to talk about, right? Yeah.
Well, as I said at the top of the interview, banditry has almost come from a quite a nice place where it used to be. There was if there was a My friend Devo first introduced me to it. His first ultra, he knew there was an ultra nearby. He just rocked up and kind of ran along the course and chatted to everyone afterwards. Didn't take a medal, wasn't doing the aid stations, and so it was almost seen as a a way to get people into races. That's obviously very different to the impact it has on a big city marathon. So
sure.
I guess when was the first time it started to be seen as an issue for you?
So there was a particular edition of the Miami Marathon that we ran out of medals. And people were livid. They were upset at me. Mm. They were upset at the business. They were just not having it. Mm. And actually, ING, if that rings a bell, but ING was the title sponsor of the New York Marathon. Mm. They were our title sponsor here in Miami. ING was the sponsor at the time, and I had conversations with some of their marketing folks, and they were upset at us. Mm. And I said, you know, I still don't think we ran out. What do you mean we didn't run out? I said, I just don't think that it was all on us. I don't think we registered more runners than we had medals. Mm. And there was, you know, we talked about a shipment that never made it, which was partially true. Not partially, it was true, but that's still, that number didn't add up. Mm. We had some breakage in the medals. Our medals, by the way, are pretty unique. They're the only, at the time, they were the only spinning medal. We were the first medal to spin. I'll take the credit for that in 2004. I thought medals were boring, and we decided to make them more fun. And so that year, I really did believe that it was out of the sheer number of people that weren't paying to run the race, and people volunteered maybe giving a few extras, and there was just numbers weren't adding up for me. And in some conversations I was having with running groups and folks that I would go out and promote the race, because there was a time where I really had to promote the Miami Marathon. I had to convince people to run, you know, because the race started with 3,400 runners. That's all we had our first year, 3,200 runners, something like
that's
that.
That's amazing.
And now now the race is, you know, close to 20,000. It sells out. We can take more, but we don't. Anyhow, I decided I was going to pay attention to Bandits that year after. And I started, because I had friends of mine saying, yeah, so-and-so runs and they don't pay, and so-and-so runs. And I thought, this is wrong. Like, this is wrong across humanity, like across capitalism, across our economic system, that people are stealing something they don't pay for. And I realized that next year, that how many people weren't paying. And I stood at
what kind of numbers are we talking about? Like what percentage?
Oh gosh, that first year, I have videos of it. Probably 500-600 runners.
Wow.
Out of a field of, at the time, was maybe 12,000 runners.
Yeah.
And okay. It was some big numbers in my eyes. And those are the ones I saw. Those weren't the runners that passed me, or the runners that went around us, or the runners that turned early.
So is that's like 4%, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Four to five, maybe percent, which makes sense. That's what that's the number I ran out of medals. You know, I ran out of that number practically, you know? And so at first I was criticized, and I put some of the video online the following year, and I would walk around with my phone. And I thought, man, I feel bad about calling people out. Maybe they don't have the money. Maybe, you know, they didn't know they had to register. I don't know. I honestly, you look at some of the videos, I think I was pretty nice about it.
I think people just don't think through the consequences. And
that's probably the biggest realization. And it took me a while to get there. You know, and I've talked to Derek Murphy a lot about this stuff at Marathon Investigation. And there's certainly a problem with integrity in our sport, like in any sport or in anything out there. There's your bad actors. But I do think that our sport suffered from a lack of information, a lack of and it may have been ignorance. Some may call it that. You know, some folks that just didn't want to learn all the ins and outs of our sport. Our sport comes from a nonprofit background. It may still very well be there in the UK, but in the States, it was largely driven by nonprofits. In fact, the New York City Roadrunners is a nonprofit group, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that brought this idea that the roads were free, that, you know, the cities paid for everything. And that's not the case. It's just not the case. There are, and this is when I started to kind of, both with our marketing team and our PR agency, we did what we could to let people know, hey, this is a business, but it's a business that has cost associated to it, like much like a store would. And if you don't walk into a store and steal a candy bar, maybe some people do, but you shouldn't be taking anything from a race. Well, I don't take the medal and I don't take this. And everybody had this justification. And I thought to myself, I'm like, that's no different than saying I'm only going to take half the candy bar. I'm only going to take the wrapper. I'm only, you know, going to take the box that the candy bar is in.
Well, I think for some people, they'd suggest that some people would do it and not take anything. And they'd suggest it's more like illegally downloading music rather than stealing a CD.
Yeah, I can see that. But fast forward to COVID. Right. Let's fast forward to 2020. Right. I think that's pretty much where everyone can agree that COVID was most present. When COVID hit, all of a sudden it became a game, or I shouldn't say a game, but a business of space. Right. Mm. You started to think about personal space. You start to think about participant experience, not overcrowding. You started to think about square footage. You were like, you started to realize that, you know, your numbers were not infinite. You had only certain amount of space. It gave us an opportunity actually to recoil a bit and reduce our crowd size. We were at one point, the Miami Marathon was close to 25,000 runners. And we started to back away from those numbers and give the runners a more space. And with that came also the education that space mattered. You took up space. You made that race more crowded. You made the start line more crowded. You made the finish line more crowded. You made parts of the water station crowded, even though you weren't taking water. And I started to speak to groups, and I'm not saying I changed all the mindsets, but I think there's a little more conscious. There's a little more information available, or at least it's been thrown out there that, hey, you may not take anything, but you're taking up space. You may not take anything physical, but there is a physical presence, if you will. The other thing that I've also sort of, and this is just anecdotal or observational even, runners think that because they're suffering through something, right? Because let's face it, running a marathon is, there's a bit of suffering. You're entitled to something for that, right? So I get the comment I get a lot near the finish line, especially if I pull somebody out, is, but wait, I've run this far. You know, I said, congrats, it's great, but you're not crossing this finish line right now because this is for the folks who bought their entry. And I, throughout the years, realized that I think it has something to do with that. Whether it's a local 5K or it's a big half marathon, people really do feel that they're owed something. They did because they've achieved something. And I think that's where the phenomenon of medals comes from, right? Like, let's face it, you didn't win, but we're still giving you a medal. And part of the reason we're giving you the medal, besides, you know, all the marketing that comes with it, giving you the medal because it is an accomplishment, you know? So yeah, my message to runners is just because you suffer doesn't mean that you exchange that suffering and that sweat for real dollars, because I can't pay my police officers with your sweat, you know.
And do you think that, because that 4%, 5%, I mean, I'm quite surprised by that number, because that's a lot higher than you'd think. And I think especially everyone thinks it's like one or two people. Do you think that's almost unique to the culture that kind of grew up around Miami for that race? Or do you think if we were to look at all races, city races at that time, it was similar stories? Or
we have, Lifetime has some properties in some of the other cities, and it's not as bad in some of the other cities. So I got to knock my, I'm a lifelong Miami and I'm a native. So I guess I'm entitled to, maybe not entitled, but I can criticize my friends and family. And so there is a cultural, the word is entitlement. The word might be, there is a cultural, I don't know what the right word is, but anyhow, there is something there that does speak to Miami's you know, I'm the center of the world. Of course, I can do what I want. And there was a boxer. I hate to give her any credit, so I'm not going to put her out there. But there's a boxer who ran our race. She printed a bib. She came out on social media, said she printed the bib, and she was really proud of this, the fact that she did so. Turns out she ends up borrowing or buying or being given a bib from someone else, and she runs with that other person's bib, which is another whole nother discussion about, you know, wearing something, someone else's number that isn't you. But she was so defiant after Derek Murphy called her out for it that she said, I don't care. When I see something I want, I go and I get it. And the spirit behind that is great. And if I was a coach, I would love my athletes to think that way, right?
Like, I know what she's goal. Yeah. I get this positivity she's trying to project with that.
Yeah.
Except that it's someone.
So I think Miami does carry some of that. She happens to be a local, where it's like, I like that car and I'm going to work my butt till I get that car. I like that clothes and that's what I'm going to go after and I'm going to get it no matter what. And that, yes, to answer your question, there's a little bit of the city to blame. I hope we turn the corner a little bit on that. I know our numbers have come down a bit from what we can observe and what we catch. And I don't want to put resources to this, but listen, New York has a team out there. Chicago has it. Everybody has their, I think Chicago has, I know New York does. Everybody has a bandit catching team and it sucks that you have to put that, but let's face it. Stores have loss prevention teams. Mm. You know, they've got their own surveillance.
And what's
I'm trying to protect the integrity of the sport too.
What's the brief for the team? What do they do? What do you tell them? Where, you know, it's a very emotive time. People moving fast and.
Yeah, look, we're not going to tackle you. I'm not going to. We do put some police officers there as sort of an added, you know, layer. Like they by the way, they can. There's a case or two that I read about. They can be charged with trespassing. We do have a permit to be on the street, even though it's a public street. Just like if tomorrow you set up a concert on a public roadway and you had it ticketed. In fact, there's an ultra music festival coming around and it's a public park that has a section of it on a public street. Mm. You need a ticket to get in there. So our ticket is your bib. And if you don't have one, you're trespassing. So you could get in trouble. Our message is, listen, let's not ridicule. Let's not get in a confrontation. Let's just ask them nicely to move off the course. And if you see all the videos that we have, it's not aggressive. You'll never see me, you know, get aggressive. Despite catching, I caught last year a lady who printed her number and she says she bought it off somebody that sold it to her printed, you know. Now we have holograms and there's certain things we've done to make, take steps, but the instructions or the training is don't touch anybody. You know, don't, you know, if they really want to run through when they get to the finish line, we also have another layer. We've layered it up, right? So you don't get caught here. You might get caught over there and you might get caught at the finish line. And I'd like to think it's at least some might say, well, Frankie, is the number coming down? I go, I don't know if the number's coming down, but I don't think it's going up. Mm. And I also think I have a responsibility for the paying customer to feel good about their payment. Right? How would you feel if you know, David, if you walked into a store, right, and everybody was walking out with things for free and you're in line to pay for it?
Yeah.
You're going to think twice about paying for it, right? So, anyhow.
And do you think it's how does this spread? Is it people are telling their friends and they're copying their friends because their friends do it and they see it acceptable? Or do you think that's independently people are deciding that it's fine for them, not based off others' experience?
There might be a handful of groups. There might be a handful of groups that talk to each other and say, the hell with it, we're not going to pay. But I think for the most part, it's individual. I really don't know. I really don't know. I'd like to change the way people see races and almost see it like as much as I don't love the airline industry as the way they charge us, the way they charge us for things. But I really would like for people to see that. And I'm sorry if this is not directly your question, but I had it on my mind. When you look at a start line, see every space as a seat, right? See it, look at it the same way you would look at a soccer game. When a soccer game or a football game sells out, it's because there's no more seats. And people don't see running that way. They're like, I can squeeze one more person in there. And I'd love to be able to have like a map that shows everybody's seat, you know, filled. And there might be one seat. All right, that one's available. You can line up in the third row, fourth column. Corral C has one spot. And that's your number. Your number is that circle. And maybe people will see this the event as a seated event or a stadium event. I don't know.
Interesting. And from the people you've pulled off, do you think there is a commonality to them?
Yeah. There's most of them are embarrassed, and they'll, oh my God, it fell. I'm sorry. You know, they, at first they start, they always give you an excuse, right? There's always, oh my God, I didn't know. And I'm like, listen, the most archaic sport, a part of our sport is that we use four safety pins for our bibs.
Okay? Yeah.
It's pretty hard to rip a Tyvek bib, okay? You know, and some come through with four pins, some of them. Like, that's the funniest. Yeah, that's pretty funny. I'm like, that was creative. You know, some wear the race shirt because their wife gave it to them and their wife paid. It's so many different stories, so many things people tell you. But I'd say the common person with half a brain knows they just did something wrong and they usually step off. They're like, all right, I got caught. There's a couple that just don't care. And they're, I'd say that's the same guy who cheats on his taxes. And I think, because as a coach, I tell my athletes, the way you run a mile, and I think this is also, it's not my quote, but I've read it somewhere. The way you run a mile is pretty much the way you run the rest of your life. If you run your mile cheating, chances are you're cheating in other parts of your life. And that's why I think there's a bigger, I'm not here to be morally better than everyone else, but I think there is a bit of a message here. Like, if you're doing this, there's a good chance you're doing other things that aren't quote unquote right in life.
What would cheating and running your mile be though?
I just threw that as an example, but maybe jumping in an Uber or something, jumping in a taxi cab and racing your way to, which, by the way, this is funny. You know that in the Boston Marathon, there was a Rosie Ruiz.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
She cheated. My last name is Ruiz. So there's a bit of irony in all
yeah,
of this.
Yeah, of course.
I got asked that before.
You're not like her had kind of lost son who's bitter that how she was treated. Or
No, not at all.
Anyway. Amazing. Well, if people want to follow you, follow what you do, what's the, you've got so many things in pies is what we say in the UK. Like, what's the best way for them to kind of track your future?
I mean, look, I'll say if they're ever in Miami, feel free to reach out to me. I'll be more than happy to go out and run with them. They can message me on Instagram at Frankie Ruiz. I'm also, those that don't know, I'm also on the Nike Run Club app. I've got an audio guided run there. If you have access to that, you can run with me there and listen to me. You know, maybe hopefully I don't bore you to death, but I got a couple runs on there.
What is that? Is that a training run or is it around part of the city?
So the Nike Run Club app, you said?
Yeah. I've never used it.
Yeah. So it's okay. So it's basically what's called an audio guided run, and I'll be in your ears and wear headphones and I'll talk you through a workout. I've got a mile repeat workout. I've got a fartlek run, I've got a long run, and I have a jogging, you know, if you're a first timer or you just want to go on an easy jog, and I'll talk
to you
jogging. About my Cuban accent maybe sounded bad there. But no, the app is synced in with your distance, and you know, as you're running, I'm talking to you as you go through your marks and your time and whatnot. And it's known as an audio guided run, and you can download that for free. It's on the Nike app itself, the Nike Running Club app or Run Club app.
Oh, fine. Okay.
But if not, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, I'm on TikTok, wherever, you know, or they can message, you know, message me through email. You can give them my email. I'd like to. So.
Well, thank you so much for your impact on, well, for coming on the poddy, but also for your impact on running for Miami and in America and the greater world. And if there's anything we can do
Have you
to,
been to Miami? Have you been to Miami?
I think I've spent 4 hours when I was a teenager transferring in a plane, but that's about it. But yeah, I'd love to.
Oh
Yeah, it
man,
seems
we gotta
wicked.
bring you here, man. We gotta bring you here. There's quite the connection with the UK here in Miami. There's been a lot of running crews that have come through as well.
Ah, interesting. It'll happen. It'll happen at some time. And likewise, if you're ever in London, let me know because we'll take you out for a run and show you the sights and the sounds.
Nice. Awesome. Well, next time anybody's in town, feel free to reach out. But thank you for having me.
There you have deep adders. Wasn't quite sure what we're going to get from that interview at the beginning because, I mean, there are other areas that Frankie's involved in that we still didn't barely touch on. But I mean, what a force for positivity in running and for Miami in general. And I do recommend if anyone passes through Miami, 1,000 people running that. Incredible. I'd love to experience the reaction of locals as you run past and just get a sense of what the energy levels are like are in it in that run. But hopefully that's been useful for some people who are either involved in running crews or thinking of doing their own ones on just how to keep it in a way that's appealing and not overcomplicate things. Because it sounds actually that's been the secret to it. He's obviously a charismatic leader, but as someone who's not tried to layer on too many things and tried to just think about having a nice run experience for a new person turning up. If I try to think of other episodes that would link in well with this one, that you'd enjoy. We fairly recently spoke to Gabe from Midnight Runners, and he was talking about starting running crews in 17 different cities around the world. And his job for the last 5 years has been going from place to place, creating these communities. And then it just when they get to the point of being self-established, self-running, real positive forces, he then moves on. So that was quite interesting. Hearing his view on that. That was episode 516. We spoke to Martin Yellen, he you probably know from Marathon Talk, about a year ago, and we really spoke to him about the whole progress of how Marathon Talk started that community and kind of where it's going and how it's that's interplayed with his life. That was episode 437. And if you're interested in finding out more to do with the training we mentioned for females around the menstrual cycles. We spoke to Renee McGregor, episode 217, and why all women's training is wrong was the title of the episode. But she goes into how you can adapt your training and be very responsive to day to day to ensure that you can train well without necessarily putting your body into deficit. If you've got any suggestions of future guests, then message me, David, at badboyrunning.com, or you can directly message on Instagram. Please do rate and subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Bye 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 bye. Bye 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 bye.
Baby, come back. Bye 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 bye. Bye 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back. Yes, and give me one more try.
Fuck you, buddy.